This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's Thursday, July 27th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The story of a coup in four short phrases. On Wednesday, what seemed to be a coup was a brew in Niger, as NPR reported.
There are reports of tension in the Western African nation of Niger. The Nigerian president has said some members of the presidential guard have tried to move against him. It's not clear if this is an attempted coup. Other African leaders are telling the guard members to stop.
Stop! Can you just stop? They didn't up the request to a diplomatic communique of knock it off, but they did ask to stop. A resounding please stop. That usually does the job. It did not do the job. For much needed context, here is the German broadcaster, DW. This is not a computerized voice. It's an actual human being giving you needed context.
Like its West African neighbors, Mali and Burkina Faso, Niger is battling extremism and is a key Western ally in Africa.
And by battling, they mean doing things like saying stop. And not only that, important people were standing by, readying their hands for a much-needed ringing.
And with instability threatening to take over the country again, Western leaders and the international community is watching on with concern.
Aha, then as the country appeared to be teetering on the butter knife's edge of tension, came this pincher movement from the all-powerful Niger ruling class.
Members of Niger's government say they don't recognize the military coup.
But the coup recognized them, or recognized no one was stopping them, so in the face of extremely surmountable obstacles, the army announced it would not be fighting to keep President Bazoum in power. And then Colonel Major Amadou Adramane announced that his forces were in control, and he did so wearing a royal blue military uniform with a plunging neckline and visible t-shirt underneath it. That was as dramatic as the coup got. The new government seems not to be only fashion-forward, but also Russia-aligned. It is the ninth coup or attempted power grab in just over 3 years in West and Central Africa, which, according to Reuters, is a region that over the last decade has made strides to shed its reputation as the coup belt. What kind of strides? If those are strides, I'd hate to see what baby steps were. The U.S. is calling for the colonel and his confederates to release former President Bazoum. On the show today, it is not the greatest spiel of all time, but it is goat-related. But first, the 2016 election posed questions we still haven't fully answered, but my next guest, Dartmouth professor and elections researcher Brendan Nyhan, has some answers. They're not bad. They're a little bit hopeful. At least the experts are. He just had with some serious research on why Trump was elected and what it could mean for 2024 and how worried you should be, or how worried very smart people are, which is to say less worried than not as informed people. Brendan Nyhan up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself. So.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Brendan Nyhan comes on this show every so often. In fact, he was the second guest in just season two because he was right at the center of studying one of the issues that I'm kind of obsessed with, this idea that we're on the verge of, I don't know, revolution or splitting up. So all of Brendan's research, which he does with an organization or a consortium called Brightline Watch, indicates that perhaps those concerns are overblown. There is a new Brightline Watch report out now that I want to get into. Also, Brendan, along with other professors, has been studying some of the effects of Facebook, how there are, I'm going to use the phrase information silos, though his report uses different phrases, just the reinforcement of information on Facebook. He designed a rigorous and fascinating study to show the extent to which that affects us as voters. Brendan Nyhan's the James O. Freeman Presidential Professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth. He's back. Brendan, welcome back to The Gist.
Great to be back.
Let's talk about the bright lines of the Bright Lines Watch. What does the latest report show?
Well, the latest report focuses most on the legal cases against Trump. We think those are some of the most important issues facing American democracy right now, and we wanted to see both what the public thought about those cases and what the political science experts, whom we poll every time we do a survey, thought about those cases. And so we looked into the perceived strength of those cases, as well as how people evaluated the evidence in each and what they thought the most appropriate punishment might be.
Yeah. So what's the public thinking?
Well, the unsurprising news to you and your audience is that we're strikingly divided by party. No one's going to be surprised by that. But I think there's some interesting findings. It is the case, for instance, that Republicans overwhelmingly think Trump didn't commit a crime when you ask them about each of the indictments that have been filed or the cases that are potentially going to be filed against him in the future. So we looked at four, the hush money case, the documents case, the potential cases around efforts to overturn the 2020 election, and potential cases around January 6th. Republicans virtually across the board don't say Trump committed a crime in any of those cases. Experts overwhelmingly do say that he committed a crime. However, relative to the last time we polled, we see a striking increase in the percentage of Republicans who say Trump committed a crime in the documents case. So it does seem like the evidence that was laid out in that indictment had some effect. And then when we drill down later and we ask people about specific charges in the documents indictment, the four main allegations that were brought forward by federal prosecutors, again, we see Republicans being actually quite split over whether Trump deserves punishment for the claims that are being made in that indictment. So it does seem like the evidence is registering. You might think of that as good news. On the other hand, we find perceptions that Joe Biden is the rightful winner of the 2020 election among Republicans, which had been increasing, flattening out. And yeah, we see about two-thirds of Republicans explicitly endorsing retribution by a future Republican president. arguing, you know, endorsing the claim that they should bring prosecutions against Joe Biden and other Democrats the next time they hold the White House. That's very discouraging.
That is, but it's also not necessarily related to the things we've been talking about, like if the election was stolen.
That's fair. That's fair. I guess there are different ways that democracy can be threatened, though. And one of them is the undermining of the rule of law, wielding the power of the state against the opposition. So, yeah. You know, one mechanism where our democracy could be under threat is if you try to overturn the results of a presidential election. We've seen that. And now we're seeing at least one party explicitly endorsing retribution in the form of politicized prosecutions. And I don't think that's at least what the special counsel case represents. But we could see how it could become the pretext to that kind of a move in the future. And that's definitely very worrisome.
The way I see it, it doesn't surprise me that right after the shocking events of January 6th, election denialism fell a little, and then it kept falling, or at least was recorded to have fallen after the midterms, in which the Trump brand was at its lowest, except maybe for January 6th. Now that Trump has come back, of course more people are going to believe in election denialism because that's what Trump is preaching. And it's hard to disaggregate the two. If Trump weren't successful, fewer people would believe in it because he wouldn't be out there making speeches and advancing this claim. But it's also true that people are supporting. The reason that Trump is leading in the polls is that people are ready to support it. So it's all tied up. Trump's popularity very closely correlates to the rise and fall in election denialism, which is maybe interesting for you and as a matter of how to figure out how people think to try to disentangle that and figure out why. But for me, it just says, you know, if Trump is defeated electorally, these attitudes will, if not go away, subside. And the more it seems like he has a chance to gain power, the more these attitudes increase. That, to me, is a bit of a bottom line.
Well, I mean, that's an optimistic thought. He can only serve one more term as president. He's quite old. He will leave the national scene one way or the other pretty soon. And if this election denialism really is a Trump-specific phenomenon, then it suggests our democracy could turn the page. And that would be a really encouraging prospect. I'm not certain, though, given the level of support for denialism that we've seen, that this will only be a Trump phenomenon. I think it is driven by him, but we may see the grassroots coming up and embracing new forms of this. Like, think about the kind of activist class of the Republican Party that drives the actions of politicians and from whom, you know, ambitious office seekers emerge. That's the kind of fever swamps out there, right, are you know, still steeped in election denial. And the defeats in 2022 should have been an important signal to the party to pivot away from that. And we're not seeing that same kind of response to this. You would often see when the electorate repudiates a brand of politics in the way that it did in that election.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the experts. I like what the experts are saying. They're more sanguine than they were last time you talked to them.
Yes, that's right. Expert evaluations of U.S. democracy. We've been asking our experts going back all the way to the beginning of the Trump presidency to evaluate American democracy on a 100-point scale. And expert evaluations of democracy reached their highest point in that entire period in this most recent survey, which is quite striking because the public actually, both Democrats and Republicans, rated democracy somewhat lower in this survey compared to our previous one. Experts, by contrast, actually went up a little bit. It's hard to know exactly why that is, but they do evaluate the cases against Trump as being beneficial to democracy. So it may be that they're reassured by the way the legal system is holding him accountable, and they see that as important in upholding democracy.
Yes.
So we'll see how their evaluations change, in particular, if more cases are brought, as seems likely.
All right. Let's talk about your Facebook study. Fascinating. What were you trying to figure out?
Yeah. So this is one of four studies that's that's being published this week by a group of independent academic researchers, including myself, in partnership with Meta, formerly Facebook, examining the role of Facebook and Instagram in the 2020 election. And so what my co-authors and I took the lead on in examining was the prevalence of people's exposure to content from like-minded sources on Facebook. So what does that mean? We wanted to understand how much people were seeing content that was congenial to their predispositions. There's been this worry out there that people online, and especially on social media, are immersed in echo chambers that just reinforce their political point of view. And so we wanted to see how prevalent that kind of exposure was on Facebook and what the effects would be of lowering exposure to content of that type. So we first measured for all Facebook users in the US, adults, during our study period, how much of the content they got was from sources that we estimate as being on their side of the political aisle. And we can talk in more detail about how we estimated that if you want to get into the details. We found about half of the content that people were exposed to came from sources on their side, broadly defined. Most of that, however, was not explicitly political. So in general, are people's information diets on Facebook, do they tend to reflect their political dispositions? Yes, absolutely. However, only about 1 in 5 people had a heavily slanted information diet where 75% or more of what they saw was from like-minded sources. So we're able to show, yes, people tend to prefer and follow and be exposed to content from sources that, you know, that they tend to agree with, but it's really only a smaller group that has this really skewed information diet. So that's right. The first main finding.
And then the question is, how affected are they by it? So you designed a study to try to test that.
That's right. We wanted to, so there's been this question, right? Not just how much of this stuff do people see, but what effect does it have on them? Is it driving the polarization that we see in our politics? And so the way we tried to evaluate that is by among a set of participants who provided informed consent to take part in an experiment, we reduced exposure to content from like-minded sources on Facebook by about a third during the study period. So a period of about 3 months, they got about a third less content from like-minded sources in their feed. So quite a substantial treatment. This is the period right around the 2020 election. There's a lot of politics going on. You're getting less content from these like-minded sources, whether it's explicitly political or not. What effect did that have? Well, people, of course, saw less of that content, and they engaged with it less as a result. Although, interestingly, conditional on seeing it, they did engage at a higher rate with the content that they did see from like-minded sources. So there is this human tendency to be responsive to that stuff. And you get less of it, so you're more interested when you do see it.
Yeah, Facebook wouldn't serve it up. I mean, that wouldn't be the business model if people weren't interested in it. That's why it's the business model.
And then most interestingly for us and for your listeners, we found no measurable effect of that reduction in exposure to content from like-minded sources on a large number of attitudinal measures related to polarization, extremity, vote choice, et cetera. So the kinds of things that people have argued echo chambers can foster, polarization, extremity, and so forth, we found no measurable effects of this approximately one-third reduction for 3 months. And so we think it's quite a striking finding, especially because when we disaggregated that in various ways to look at different subgroups, we saw no evidence that there were particular subgroups that were differentially more or less responsive either. It seemed to be kind of across the board. We just weren't seeing evidence that attitudes were moving. So yeah. I think that's quite a striking finding.
Yeah. If people look at the survey, there is a chart and it has attitudes, the treatment effects. So, you know, something, it goes from -1 to 1, which would be a mass 180 degree change in one direction to another. It's all along the zero effect axis. There are some effects that are maybe, you know, half a degree to the right of it. So really people, you turn off the echo chamber, at least the Facebook echo chamber, and you turn it off around a very key time around the election, and it just didn't change people's minds. So a couple reasons why this may be that occur to me, and you note them in the study. Maybe people forever, how much they're on Facebook, and Facebook is said to be the shaper of opinions as a part of their overall media diet. Maybe Facebook is infinitesimal. Was that something you could measure?
Only in part. We can't know what their friends told them, what they saw on TV, and so forth. But it's certainly the case, right, that this is just what you see on social media is just a fraction of all the political information you're exposed to. So by the standards of the social science that's ever been conducted, I think this is one of the most ambitious field experiments that's ever been done in terms of shaping people's information diets. On the other hand, they were still getting lots of other information from other sources.
Maybe from other online sources. Maybe they knew it. They didn't know what was going on. That's part of the experiment, right? They didn't know
condition they were in. That's right.
Right. So maybe they just weren't liking it and their Facebook use declined. Well, you would know that. They started going on, I don't know, TikTok or some other source of online information that could be an echo chamber. Was that going on?
We consider that possibility. We found no measurable effect on how much time they spent on Facebook. They don't seem to have substituted away from Facebook. And we found no evidence that they were, their information diet in their web browsing for the subset of respondents where we had web browsing data as well, that patterns of web browsing were changing either. So we're not able to observe all their behavioral changes potentially in every medium, but the ones we were able to see, we didn't see evidence of them compensating in other areas.
Now, there is a study that I covered, I'm sure you're aware of it, where they switched CNN for Fox for some viewers. You know, your normally upscale coffee has been replaced by Brim, and then the guy can't taste the difference. But they found effects. They found that the viewer's knowledge of certain news items totally changed, and they found their opinions changed in that study. I don't know if you've looked in depth at that study, but how would you take that study and your study and either square them or make them tell a coherent story?
Yeah, I think that's a really important study to juxtapose with ours. And I think people who are examining this research will definitely be putting those in conversation. That one, in some ways, even more dramatic. If I recall correctly, it was people who watch Fox in primetime paying them to watch CNN instead. So that's a very direct substitution in a group that was otherwise getting a very high dosage of the kind of content of concern, and replacing it directly with another kind of high dosage content, right? So this political news of one type and then substituting a very different form. And one thing actually I want to note about ours, we wanted to evaluate the kinds of interventions that platforms might consider. And so when exposure to content from like-minded sources is decreased, we looked at what replaced it. So unlike in that study where they replaced the Fox consumption with CNN, this is whatever else they were following, right, was ranked relatively higher in their feed. They're more likely to see it. And it turns out a lot of what people see when you downrank content from like-minded sources is not political, and it's also not necessarily from the other side of the aisle. It's these sources that kind of fall somewhere in the middle that we classify as neither like-minded to the user or cross-cutting, meaning on the other side. So a lot of the void ends up being filled by these sources that don't have a strong political valence. And so that may be an important difference from that other case where they really were getting the CNN version of reality instead of the Fox one every single night.
So knowing what you know as a studier of media, do you think that this study, because it does cross-cut against a dominant narrative that our media is siloed and inaccurate, and we're studying for misinformation. Do you think this study is going to get as much widespread attention as, say, the CNN Fox study did?
Yeah, to be determined. I'm optimistic. This is a historic partnership. We think it's a real innovation in social science research to be able to have an independent academic group working with a platform in this way. So we're really excited about the research. At the same time, it's certainly true. People want simple stories and simple answers, right? And social media causing all the polarization we see is a simple story. And studies that purport to have a simple answer, of course, are likely to be splashier than one like ours, which says, look, it's complicated. The way this study comes out shouldn't let Meta or anybody else off the hook. right? It's very important to have data transparency so that future studies like this can be conducted. And going forward, that's going to be a really important way to make sure we continue to learn about social media instead of the door slamming shut, which is potentially what could happen. We've already seen Twitter and Reddit, for instance, cutting down on researcher access to data in a really worrisome way.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So Facebook cooperated with you and they had no way to shut you down once they gave you the information. But do you think that had you and these other studies showed that there really was this huge echo chamber effect and taking it away increased people's attitudes or changed people's attitudes, do you worry that they'd shut down the next study?
I have no idea. I can't speak for Meta. It is what it is. So I would just say to your listeners that, this study was built from the ground up to protect the integrity of the findings. The academics received no money from Meta. Academic authors had final control rights over every analysis decision and every word of the manuscript. And all of the analyses were pre-registered in advance before anyone had access to the data. So before anyone knew what the results would be, everyone had signed off on an analysis plan that had been filed in an independent archive in a timestamp form. You can go look it up and read it yourself.
Yeah.
So I think we really can have confidence in these results. How it will affect the behavior of platforms going forward, I don't know. But I guess regardless of how the findings turn out, and there'll be many more studies, many more articles coming out of this study, Mike. Some of those may be more or less favorable to Meta. Let the chips fall where they may. I mean, I'm interested in the science here. And I just think it's going to be really important to continue this stream of research because the topic is so important.
Last question. I don't think you've done a direct study on this, but I know you're familiar with the scholarship. What has all the analysis found the effect of Russian attempts at disinformation in the 2016 election to have been?
So my colleague, Josh Tucker, who's one of my collaborators on the research we've been talking about, he and his colleagues have a really important study that just came out on this. They found evidence that is inconsistent with any substantial influence on vote choice in the 2016 election. Only 1% of users on Twitter were responsible for 70% of the exposures to Russian disinformation accounts. And those folks who were exposed were overwhelmingly Republicans already. And they find no evidence of any association between exposure to that content and changes in political attitudes, voting, et cetera. There's just no evidence of substantial effects there. It certainly doesn't mean that one couldn't imagine an influence campaign being successful. But I think one broad takeaway across a number of social science findings is it's pretty hard to change people's minds, actually, especially when it comes to high salience topics like presidential elections.
Brendan Nyhan is the James O. Friedman Presidential Professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He's the co-director of the Bright Line Watch. Thanks again, Brendan.
Thanks for having me.
And now the spiel. Dateline, Pinole, California. The Daily Beast reports a California neighborhood was briefly taken over by a horde of goats this week after they escaped their enclosure. And while the Daily Beast is for once living up to its name, it's not a horde of goats, it's a herd of goats. And if you've not heard of goats, you will hear one faintly in this video clip provided by the Pinole PD. It's titled Officers Respond to the 1800 Block of Shea Drive.
There's nothing we can do until the herder gets here.
If you're thinking, come on, Pinole PD, you can rustle a goat or two. No. You could. I mean, they could have rustled a goat or two, but there were at least 100 goats grazing on what looked to be a suburban cul-de-sac. Now, if you're asking, okay, fun animal story in suburbia, staple of lighthearted local news fare, but why on the gist, Mike? Well, first of all, I always say if it bleats, it leads. But secondly, remember a couple days ago I was talking about the Peruvian goat herders, Cabrera, who were to be paid $191,000 a year? Goats, you see, are in high demand to clear vegetation as California prepares for the wildfire season. But overtime laws in California have affected goat herds. Goat herds have to be on call 24/7, and they calculate that into the overtime fees. So the floor, the minimum for goat herders went from $1,955 in 2019 to $3,730 this year, and it's set to hit $4,381 in 2025. That's the minimum. With overtime, it's going to be $14,000 a month, according to the AP. The Sacramento Bee had an even higher calculation, $191,000 a year. Maybe the goat herds let their beasts loose to demonstrate your worth. One of those, nice quadruped ruminant vegetation abatement program you got there. Shame if someone let them all loose on the 1800 block of Shea Drive. The companies that hire the herders make a compelling case that they can't possibly afford to pay them that much. So you know how every time anyone threatens a cut in the city budget, the talking point is always, well, we're going to have to close down firehouses, and that's to frighten the citizenry that their houses are going to burn down. Well, something similar, but even better, is going on. According to Tim Arrowsmith, owner of Western Grazers, he's quoted by the AP saying that without a fix to new regulations, quote, we will be forced to sell these goats to slaughter and the auction yards and will be forced out of business and probably file for bankruptcy. So in other words, it's the equivalent of we're going to have to close down the firehouses, you'll probably have a lot more fire, and also we'll be killing all the firemen. And then who will pose for calendars wearing only their mustaches? Who, I ask? The 1800 block of Shea Drive has been contained, by the way. The California Assembly, though, has not acted on the bill to address what is called the targeted grazing operators, precision-guided ovines. It seems that it's not just a mix-up in the legislation, as some reporting had me believe, but there are quotes from Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher, who is in charge of the California Labor Federation, saying vaguely, yeah, maybe $191,000 for goat herders does seem a scooch high, but she is not willing to cave on a wage cut. So the possibility of the world's richest goat herders setting up shop in small trailers in the foothills of Northern California, a real possibility. And the 1800 block of Shea Drive might just be a harbinger, a warning, or an aberration, or perhaps a calling card for $191,000 a year workers. $191,000 a year. You heard right. And that's it for today's show. Corey War is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is chief ovine officer of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.
Anne, it's terrific. We're only $100 from our target.
Helen, you deserve a cup of coffee.
Whoa, only half a cup? Don't you like my coffee?
Love the rich taste. It's the caffeine I can do without.
You happen to be drinking Brim decaffeinated coffee.
This is Brim?
This is Brim, and it's decaffeinated, so you don't have to stop at half a cup.
If it tastes this rich, I don't want to stop.
Fill it to the rim. With Brim?
Fill your cup to the rim with the rich taste of Brim.